Wir setzen uns für sauberes Wasser für alle Lebewesen ein. Darum sind wir Teil der Blue Community. Bei uns folgt jeden Sonntagabend um 8 Uhr eine Sendung zum Thema Wasser. Und jetzt kommt die nächste Folge. Viel Spass! Meine Definition von Hoffnung ist das Festhalten und Beschützen von allem, was gut ist, für die zukünftigen Generationen und den Planet. Diese Worte stammen von Maud Barlow, einer kanadischen Autorin und Aktivistin. Ihre Worte sind passend und treffend und um sie geht es in der heutigen Blue Community Sendung. Zuerst werde ich euch aber kurz etwas mehr über sie erzählen. Die Maud Barlow, geboren 1947, ist eine kanadische Autorin und Aktivistin. Sie ist Gründungsmitglied der kanadischen Bürgerrechtsorganisation Council of Canadians, die sich international für Wassergerechtigkeit einsetzt. Sie war auch Beraterin des 63. Präsidenten der Generalversammlung der Vereinigten Nationen in Wasserfragen und spielt eine wichtige Rolle in der Kampagne für die Anerkennung von Wasser als Menschenrecht durch die UNO im Jahr 2010. In ihrem unermüdlichen Einsatz für die Förderung von Wasser als Menschenrecht, öffentliches Gut und Teil des globalen Gemeindewesens folgt sie im Grundsatz «Wasser ist Leben». Darüber hinaus waren Maud Barlows Visionen und Engagement ausschlaggebend für die Entwicklung der Blue Community Bewegung, die vor gut 10 Jahren in Kanada ihre Anfänge hatte. Inzwischen gibt es weltweit eine wachsende Zahl von Blue Communities. Städte, Gemeinden, Kirchen und Universitäten, die sich zu wichtigen Wasserprinzipien bekennen. Die nachhaltige Nutzung von Wasserressourcen, die Anerkennung von Wasser als öffentliches Gut, die Wasserversorgung und die Abwasserversorgung durch die öffentliche Hand, der Zugang von sauberem Wasser als Menschenrecht und die Verwendung von Leitungswasser anstatt von Flaschenwasser. Die Universität Zürich ist im Mai 2022 anlässlich einer Veranstaltung mit der Maud Barlow offiziell ein Mitglied der Blue Community Bewegung geworden. Und mit dieser unglaublich inspirierenden Frau durfte ich ein Interview machen und eins kann ich vorab nehmen. Ihre Worte sind berührend, klar und gleich so unglaublich hoffnungsvoll, dass man sich nur gut fühlen kann nach einem Gespräch mit ihr. Das Interview ist jetzt natürlich auf Englisch. Aus Zeitgründen kann ich leider nicht alles übersetzen. Darum wird in dieser Sendung keine Übersetzung meinerseits zum Schluss folgen. Falls ihr aber ein bisschen Mühe habt mit dem Englisch und gleich wollt hören, was sie zu erzählen hat, was ich herzlichst empfehle, dann könnt ihr auf unsere Homepage unter radiochico.ch unter der Rubrik «Blue Community», wo ihr übrigens auch immer alle vergangenen «Blue Community»-Sendungen zum Nachlesen findet, gehen. Und dort findet ihr unter der heutigen Hauptsendung eine Audiodatei, wo das Ganze noch auf Deutsch übersetzt wird. So, jetzt habe ich genug geredet. Wir starten zusammen in das Gespräch mit der Maud Barlow. Ich wünsche euch ganz viel Spass beim Zuhören. Am Mikrofon für euch ist Sarah. Maud Barlow, born in 1947, is a Canadian author and activist. She is a founding member of the Canadian civil rights organization Council of Canadians and the Blue Planet Project, which campaigns for water justice internationally. She also served as an advisor of water issues to the 63rd President of the United Nations General Assembly and played a leading role in the campaign for the UN to recognize water as a human right in 2010. In her tireless efforts to promote water as a human right, public good and part of the global common, she follows the principle that water is life. In addition, Maud Barlow's vision and commitment were decisive for the development of the Blue Community Movement, which began in Canada a good 10 years ago. There are now a growing number of Blue Communities, cities, municipalities, churches and universities around the world that are committed to important water principles, the sustainable use of water resources, the recognition of water as a public good, water supply and wastewater disposal by public authorities, access to clean water as a human right, and the use of tap water instead of bottled water. The University of Zurich officially became a member of the Blue Community Movement in May 2022 at an event with Maud Barlow. Good afternoon, Mrs. Barlow. Reading all this about you, congratulations, you have created something really impressive.
Well, that's lovely to say. Thank you so much. It's my pleasure to be here.
What was like the starting point to become an activist?
You know, I learned activism with my morning breakfast when I was a child. My father was a very dedicated social justice activist. In fact, my father led the fight against capital punishment, but he led the fight for justice for Indigenous youth. And so I taught as a young person, if you're lucky enough to live in a place when you have the freedom to speak and not to be intimidated by caring, that you have a responsibility to give something back. So actually, I was very politically aware as a child and right through my growing up years, and then got into the women's movement in my 20s and 30s.
And you also are the founder of Blue Community, and you have implemented the UN Human Right Water for Everyone. Why is it so important to you to stand up for the right to water for all?
Well, it's really important that we understand the twin crises in our world around water. One is ecological. That is that we are destroying the finite water supply, the water heritage that we have as humans on Earth at a really alarming rate. We're polluting it, we're diverting it, we're damming it. We're over-extracting groundwater as if it would go on forever, because we all learned back at school, it can't ever go anywhere. There's all this water on the planet. Don't worry about it. Well, it turns out that's not true. The demand for water is far exceeding supply, and so we have an ecological crisis. At the same time, we have a human crisis, and that is partly because we are still creating deep inequality in our world within countries and among countries and among groups of people and so on. And so we know that right now, every day, a quarter of the population of the world doesn't have access to clean drinking water. And we know that every day that half of the population of the world doesn't have proper sanitation accessible to them. In fact, when we all learned about COVID, 3.5 years ago, we were told wash your hands with soap and warm water. And the UN put out a statement reminding us that half of the population of the world doesn't have a place to do that. So it's very, very urgent. I would argue that in terms of sheer numbers of people affected, that the lack of access to water and sanitation is the greatest killer, the greatest human rights violation of our time. And so we have to look at these twin issues of caring for, protecting, and restoring watersheds and sharing water more justly. And that's why it mattered so much to have the United Nations recognize the human rights to water and sanitation. It's not an issue of charity. It's not a need that can be filled by, some group from afar. It's a human right. It's an issue of justice. And it's terribly important to see it that way.
What inspired you to become an activist for the water rights, and how has your journey shaped your understanding of this critical issue?
Well, that's a great question. It was really two kind of strands of my life. I was working very much in the women's movement here in Canada, and realized that one of the major issues for women internationally, including violence against women, was the lack of access to water. And even women would have to go for kilometers or miles every day and take their girl children out of school. So I realized the lack of access to water was a women's issue in many other countries, particularly countries of the global south. At the same time, I was watching how free trade agreements, like ones in my country and others, and the World Bank and others were starting to talk about water as a tradable good, water as an economic good. We were starting to see what I call the privatization and commodification of water, where big corporations were coming in and sometimes often with the World Bank backing them into the global south and saying, if you want funding for water services, you have to go with a private for-profit company. We were deeply opposed to that. So I realized that not only was water a huge human rights issue, particularly for women, but I realized that big corporations understood before a lot of us did that water in a world with the water declining, the actual access to water declining and the demand growing, that whoever controls water would be rich and powerful. And therefore, big transnational corporations are in there to run the water services on a for-profit basis, to trade water, water trading. Now we've got water futures trading in California. So I sounded the alarm and started doing some research about who owns water, who's making decisions around water. We all think it comes out of the tap or out of the pump or whatever. But really, there are political decisions being made around who has access and who doesn't. And I was determined to try to find this out. And in so doing, I really traveled all around the world, helped build an international water justice movement, fighting for water and sanitation for all.
So beside that, like fighting for water for all, you also founded Blue Community, and this all started in Canada. And for a long time, Canada was one of the most water richest countries in the world. How is it today?
Water, the Blue Communities is a wonderful project for where municipalities can promise not to privatize water, can promise to protect the human right to water, and water is a public trust, can promise if there is clean, accessible water coming out of the tap that they won't have plastic bottled water. So this was a pledge that we started in our country because at the time we had a right-wing government that was promoting water privatization services. So we wanted the municipalities to say no. So, but it spread, as you know, to Europe, and particularly starting in Switzerland, where there's a huge Blue Communities project, and around other parts of Europe, and is now moving into areas in America. I want to have a dream that the world will turn blue. One city, one town, one village, one university, one school at a time, even one person at a time, that we start thinking blue. So for me, it's really important that we understand, and this gets back to your question about Canada, that there's nowhere in the world that this isn't an issue. There are some parts of the world where it's much more critical right now. Let's be honest, right? In India, in many parts of China, in the Middle East, in 22 countries in Africa, there are water availability crises. It's not just the human crisis, but it's the lack of access to clean water is now here. But we tend to think that in some countries like Canada, like Switzerland, like Germany, that there's so much water we don't have to worry about it. And that is wrong. Everyone everywhere must understand that the water crisis is a global crisis, that when many people are leaving their countries as migrants, searching to find a different place to live, a safe place to live, it's not just violence and conflict that they're fleeing, it's often because there's no water left and therefore they can't grow food and therefore they're hungry. So the water issue is a global issue. And in my country, we have taken water totally for granted. And we need to think, you know, many years ahead and think of what it's going to be like as we overextend, overuse the groundwater, don't take care of our surface water properly. And in Switzerland, as you well know, the big issue, of course, is the melting glaciers. Right now, Switzerland is considered the water tower of Europe, but the notion that that'll be here forever, we really have to put that out of our minds. I mean, we really have to start thinking about what it's going to be like when those glaciers melt, when that water isn't there anymore, or certainly isn't there in that quantity. And we have to be conscious and aware. I call it thinking blue. And it's not just for some parts of the world, it's for all of us.
So as an activist, how do you approach governments and corporations to effect meaningful changes in water politics?
Well, we need good laws. Martin Luther King, a wonderful civil rights leader in the United States, said, legislation, laws, may not change the heart, but they can restrain the heartless, which is just a really important thing if you think of it. If you don't have rules and you have, say, two corporations operating, and one corporation does care about the environment and does care about its employees and pays them decently and protects the local environment, then they're not going to be able to compete with a corporation right beside them that doesn't care, that dumps its pollution in the river and, you know, does all that stuff. But if you have laws that both the first corporation and the second corporation have to obey, then they're competing on a level playing field that protects the environment. We have to have good laws. We need them at municipal level. We need them at the state and provincial level. We need them at the national level, and we need them internationally. And so this is really why international accords, not only on climate change, but on biodiversity and on plastics. We've got to do something with the plastics crisis that is exploding around us. These will happen internationally as well, or have to happen internationally as well as at the local level. So I am a deep believer in good governance. I mean, there's a place for the private sector, an important place in laying the pipes and building the infrastructure and coming up with alternatives to good technology to protect water and so on. But decisions around who has access to water should be done democratically, in public hands. It should not be done with a for-profit motive. And so I tend not particularly to work with corporations. I tend to work to get with groups, to get governments to bring in good legislation so that all the private sector companies and government have to operate within certain limits, within certain regulations, with understanding the need to protect our planet Earth and water.
So you said the government is really important, but in your book called Whose Water Is It Anyway, you discuss also the privatization of water. How can communities and government work together to prevent the commodification of this essential resource?
Well, we really hope that governments, the municipalities around the world, will just say no to privatization. And in fact, we are winning that one. There are almost 350 cities now around the world that tried privatization of water services and decided it was a mistake and went back to brought back the management of water into public hands. Paris is an example. Many French cities in France had their water run by Veolia or Suez, the two biggest companies in the world. And they've taken their water back. Berlin is another one, a great big city that sold off their water to a private company, to a couple of private companies, and the price of water soared through the roof. The quality was poor. They were very unhappy with the situation. And so they held a referendum and they voted to take their water back under public hands. So this is an example where the local populace, the people, demanded change and got their local government to then implement it. And Berlin then became a blue community, promising never to privatize again. So you can do this at a municipal level, but you can also do this at a national level and say, no, we are not privatizing. We are commitment to water as a human right, which all the countries of the UN have now adopted, all of them. Our commitment to water and sanitation as human rights is a government responsibility. It's not one you turn over to a for-profit corporation. So we need to fight privatization of water and commodification of water at many, many levels.
So as you said, you worked all around the world with different people. Is there a specific success stories or innovation approaches from different parts of the world that you find particularly inspiring in the standing up for water justice?
Well, I have big congratulations to your own country. I think Switzerland has cared about its water. I know that the cities of Zurich and Bern prioritized being able to swim in the lakes and the rivers there. So I often speak about Switzerland and Germany as being another very good example of countries that have cared for their water. I also write about examples around the world that have tried different systems. The two cities at the mouth of the Murray-Darling River in Australia, where the Murray-Darling was running out of water, one city said, well, we'll go expensive desalination, which is expensive and polluting. And another city said, no, we're going to go with nature. And they built all these wetlands and protected their water and grew more trees and more wetlands to protect the water. And they brought not only the water back, but they brought nature back. So there are wonderful examples around the world where communities and governments have worked together to say, we can protect nature. We have an environmental hero in our country called David Suzuki. And David Suzuki says that if we stop hurting nature, it will be kinder to us than we deserve because we have taken nature for granted. And this is part of the problem. And the more modern we get in our societies and the more industrial and the more stuff we have and the more cars we have and the more technology we have, the more we tend to think of nature as a resource instead of saying, no, nature and water give us life, and we have to start adapting to nature, not saying nature has to adapt to us. And when I see the floods and the droughts and the, you know, the nature fighting the fires, the nature kind of fighting back, to me it's like nature saying, you're not the boss, you can't control us. Nature, as the one famous environmentalist said, nature bats last. We have to live differently with nature. And this is the whole understanding of taking care of and restoring biodiversity, what they call rewilding, allowing nature to come back. And there are many, many examples around the world that are quite exciting. And many treaties and agreements that are in the works. It's part of what makes me kind of hopeful right now is that I see governments and leaders around the world, even corporate leaders, coming together and saying, we need to restore nature. We need to plant new trees and stop cutting down old trees. And we need to stop cutting down wetlands. Wetlands are the protection. They're the lungs of our watersheds. And we just take them down as if there's no tomorrow. So I think there's a turning in our heads around this. And I think it's a very positive thing.
I feel like hearing this makes me or makes us a bit more hopeful for our future. And this brings me a bit to the next topic I would like to talk about with you. You are also the author and co-author of several influential books, including the book Still Hopeful. And at the beginning of the book, you explained why you wanted to write this book. And I found it a really touching story. Can you maybe explain this story? What evening or what day was like the starting point for you to write this book?
Well, it was just before COVID. It was a lovely June evening here in my city in Ottawa, Canada. And at a big old church, we had a huge event on the climate crisis and some famous speakers. And the place was absolutely full. It had lots of people and lots of young people, including my then 16-year-old granddaughter, Eleanor. And I found the speakers too negative. One after another just got up and said the worst things about the future is the end of the planet and the sixth great extinction. And I could see the young people in the audience kind of thinking, oh my God, you know, this is just awful. When I got up to speak, I spoke about hope and I spoke about our Blue Communities Project and I spoke about the need to take action and what a wonderful a person calls wise hope, which is, you know, not being silly and thinking there's no problem, but understanding that even though we do have issues, that there's lots to be done and it is not hopeless. Because I really worry about young people getting this message that there's nothing to be done. It's just an awful message to a young generation. So I said that, and then we got into quite a debate after. I was quite controversial because people said, well, you're not telling the truth about how bad things are. And I thought, that's not true. I've written many books telling people how bad the water situation is. Anyway, when that was over, my granddaughter came up with several of her friends, and one of them was in tears. And she said, if you hadn't talked about hope, I don't think I would have ever come back to anything like this again. I was so devastated by the speakers before you. And so walking home that night, I remember thinking, I've got to write about hope. I've got to write about building a movement, not thinking that you're the center of everything and understanding that sometimes you win something and sometimes you don't win and you can't give up. And you have to be kind to yourself and be kind to one another, but you have to keep going. And so I talked about lessons that I've learned from a lifetime of activism, which is why I wrote the book on hope. And I talk about in the book, as you know, about the difference between grief and despair, because I think it's good to have grief if you understand the issues that are happening, particularly issues of war that are happening right now in the world. There's a lot of grief, right? But despair is different. Despair is a dead end. Grief can lead you to a catharsis and then to action. But despair leads you somewhere else and to a dead end, basically. And so I want people to feel that, you know, my definition of hope is that it's a commitment to protecting all that is good for the planet and future generations, even though you can't control it all, but taking action anyway and having some faith that others are doing the same thing, because you don't know all the wonderful things that are happening around the world, and you have to have some faith that there are other people who think like you and are doing what they can do in ways that you don't even know about.
If you are looking at the next generation of leaders and advocates, what advice do you have for young activists who are equally passionate about water issues but also environmental sustainability?
Well, just find your path. Find the path that feels good for you. I have looked back on my career. I've never actually worked for anything that already existed. I've always been kind of the first, or I created something that I thought, you know, who's doing such and such? And if nobody's doing it, well, then we better create it. So don't look for the comfortable path. Don't assume that there's a ABC that you're just going to automatically move into a slot. Be an activist. Care about it. Think about this, as this poet says, you've got one wild and beautiful life. What are you going to do with it? You know, committing yourself to justice and to protecting Mother Earth is absolutely a life choice that you make. And no matter what you do during the day to make a living for your family or whatever, you can still care. You can still do things. And that's the message I would give to young people, is to make that commitment. Find out who else is doing this kind of work. Surround yourself with people who care, because there are people who will go after you for caring, as we know. So build positivity into your life and take a deep breath. And I say the life of an activist is the best life. You get up in the morning caring about things other than yourself and money. And that's true. And that's really important. I actually think it's important for your health. I have no proof of that, but I believe it.
I heard in an interview from the Nobel Prize Dialogue that at least a few months ago, you spent every weekend in a cabin in the woods without any access to internet. Was there any specific reason behind going this into the silence?
I think for a lot of us, we need to disconnect now and then. You know, you think of people my age as being ignorant about technology, but it isn't true. I mean, we're just as addicted as people your age, or at least I am. And so it's really important sometimes to come back to nature and to come deeply back into our relationship with nature. The Japanese people call it forest bathing, you know, to be in old growth forest, to reconnect with Mother Earth and with water is terribly important. Until I got involved in the water issue politically, I never thought about water. It's just something that came out of the tap and later out of a bottle, right? And I have changed my relationship to water quite profoundly, understanding how important it is, how life-giving it is, how awful it is not to have it. Because I've been in many places in the world where people do not have access to clean water. And so I've created a kind of a spiritual relationship to water and nature. And I worry about young people that grow up in huge cities and never touch nature, don't see the growth of plants in the spring, and don't get that sense of rhythm of the wild. So finding, going back to our roots, and our roots are our Mother Earth, is really important every now and then.
What would you pass along, especially to younger people, on how they can remain optimistic for their future and how they also can like become active and really do something and not only like talk about it?
Well, life is a gift. Life is joy. Life is a privilege. And embrace it and stand for something and become an activist and care. And I swear to you, I'm speaking to all the young people, I swear to you, you can make a difference. And it's wonderful when you make a difference. It's wonderful when you know that you've worked and fought for something and you've changed something and you've actually succeeded in advancing our little human family, you know, and the work in the world in some way. It's a wonderful, wonderful feeling. So don't be overwhelmed. Don't be overwhelmed by the problems. We can solve these problems that we've got in our world are all human-made. If humans can make the problems, we can make the solutions. And you want to be part of the solution, not part of the problem. So it's really, really important to get up in the morning, take a deep breath, be grateful for life, and go out and help make the world better.
Eine unglaublich faszinierende Frau, die Hoffnung verbreitet und Lösungen für die jetzigen Probleme sucht. An alle, die noch ein gutes Weihnachtsgeschenk suchen oder sich jemandem oder auch einem selber ein Geschenk machen wollen, dann kann ich sehr das Buch, von dem wir geredet haben, «Still Hopeful» von Maud Barlow empfehlen. Das Buch verbreitet Hoffnung und ist gleichzeitig auch sehr lernreich. Und somit sind wir auch schon am Ende der heutigen Sendung angekommen. Wie gesagt, die deutsche Übersetzung sollte ab nächster Woche auf unserer Webseite unter der Rubrik «Blue Community» aufgeladen sein. Und nehmt nach Herzen, was sie gesagt hat. Hoffnungsvoll bleiben und jeden Tag versuchen, die Welt ein Stückchen besser zu machen. Dann wünsche ich euch noch einen wunderschönen Sonntagabend, morgen einen guten Start in die neue Woche. Und das Lied, das ich ausgewählt habe, ist zwar Käse, das mit Wasser zu tun hat, dieses Mal. Und gleich habe ich einfach das Gefühl, es passe zu dieser Sendung. Darum kommt hier jetzt noch «We are the world» von «USA for Africa». Tschüss zusammen und habt's gut.
Must come together as one. There